You need some amount of just practical thinking through and collaboration with the people who would implement programs to say, what's feasible for you? What's realistic? And then what would it look like to implement these things in your country?
Welcome to a special episode of OxDev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Normally on OxDev Talks, we talk about a particular intervention. The questions we always ask are, is it better than the alternative? How well would it work in other places? Can we make this work better? The answers are never straightforward. But if we're to achieve large-scale, cost-effective impact, should we be thinking more systematically about the best way to design, test, and implement these interventions? Well, that's the mission of Airbell Impact Lab, and today I'm talking to Jeannie Annan and Caitlin Tullock, who are respectively Chief Research and Innovation Officer and Associate Director of Best Use of Resources. You both have terrific job titles. Welcome to VoxDev Talks, Jeannie.
Thanks, Tim. Great to be here.
And Caitlin, welcome as well.
Hi, Tim. Thanks so much.
First, how would you describe Airbell Impact Lab? I had a go, but I think you can do a better job.
Sure. Airbell Impact Lab is IRC's research and innovation team. So the International Rescue Committee's research and innovation or research and development team. IRC is a humanitarian organization. It's, I believe, the largest humanitarian organization. We work in 40 countries responding to emergencies and protracted crises and conflict and respond to improve their lives in health, in education, in safety, in economic recovery, and in power, what we call power or in governance. So Airbell Impact Lab's mission is to design, test, and scale life-changing interventions for people affected by conflict. And we work across these outcomes for IRC. We're a team of researchers, of economists, of analysts, designers, so human-centered designers, behavioral scientists, and strategists. And we work with IRC's frontline workers, those who are delivering programs, our technical specialists across these outcome areas to do this designing, testing, and improving of programs.
Well, it's a pretty unusual organization. So who created it? Whose idea was it? And why?
This is Jeannie. I co-founded it with a colleague, Ravi Gurumurthy, who now is the CEO of Nesta, based in the UK. And we co-founded about 6+ years ago when David Miliband had come in as the CEO of IRC. And we've had the research team and the best use of resources team for a number of years and had been testing interventions and doing impact evaluations. But what we wanted to do is bring in the best of design and iteration and kind of human-centered and behavioral science part from the private sector. And so we co-founded Airbell Impact Lab to bring in that private sector iteration, human-centered design element. And then ultimately, a couple of years ago, brought together both the research, best use of resource analytical side with this design strategy, behavioral insight team to have the full scale across design and testing of interventions.
It's a fascinating idea, but can you give me an idea about the sort of interventions and the sort of places that you focus on here?
So we have 4 priority areas, and then I can zoom in on one of them. So one is tackling malnutrition for under 5-year-olds. The second is sexual, reproductive, maternal, and newborn health. The third is on last mile education, reaching kids both out of school, but also quality of school for in-school kids. And the newest is climate resilient agriculture. So zooming in terms of what we actually do in these areas. So if I talk about malnutrition for a minute, there are 19 million kids in humanitarian spaces that are acutely malnourished, that has incredible lifelong consequences. And these right now, as far as we understand, 1 in 5 of those kids are receiving treatment for acute malnutrition. It's a treatment that we know works and helps them recover. For the vast majority of kids, it's basically peanut butter fortified with some nutrients. Mm-hmm. Take that for 12, 16 weeks, give the kid that, and most of them recover out of this acute malnutrition phase. But the majority of them have not been receiving this treatment. So we and our brilliant nutritionists designed a new health protocol. So it was somewhat complicated to diagnose and to treat despite the simple treatment because of the way that the system was set up between moderately malnourished kids and severely acutely malnourished kids. So the nutritionist designed a new protocol that would simplify that in a continuum and simplify both the diagnosis and the treatment. We then tested that using a randomized controlled trial, found that it was just as effective as the more complicated version of that health protocol. Mm-hmm. And then we designed the tools to provide this in order for community health workers that have basically no or very little reading and writing skills to be able to deliver this. Right now, it's delivered in health facilities. And so you have to actually walk to a clinic sometimes for hours. You can imagine what a mother's life is like who has an acutely malnourished kid. It's going to be very difficult for them to get to a health clinic. So we designed tools that community health workers could deliver with the same level of accuracy as clinicians in a clinic. Again, tested that. And those community health workers in South Sudan had a 96% accuracy use of these. It's all with colors and pictures for them to use it. So those were the two things, this health protocol. We designed the tools then in a different way. We're now working on the supply chain. Supply of the peanut butter, fortified peanut butter, is very difficult and there are many stockouts. We're now looking at different ways to deliver and design that supply chain. And we've been working on policy change. UNICEF and WFP deliver this in different ways. They're not currently using the full simplified protocol despite the evidence to support it. And so we're working on the policy change. So that gives you a sense just in this one area of from the intervention itself, the health protocol, how the tools are delivered and how it's delivered, the supply chain and the policy. We've been trying to work across that spectrum so that 5 in 5 kids are receiving this treatment as opposed to 1 in 5 are receiving it.
When you talk about the details and the subtleties like this, you can see how big the task is. Now, every week on Vox Dev Talks, we talk to really talented researchers working hard, trying to make a difference. And of course, what comes up every week is that gap between the best of research and how we implement that in practice. You see that gap every day. What are the implications of this at the moment?
I guess I would think of this gap in two ways, and I want to kind of unpack both of these. On the one hand, there is a gap where we have something that is very, very well researched, that is known to be highly effective, and yet the gap remains between that thing that's proven to be effective, cost effective, and like actually being implemented at scale. On the other hand, being based within an implementing organization, what you see are a number of programs that are operating at scale, that are operationally efficient, that are well known and used, but that are not as well grounded in evidence or not as effective as they could be. I like to think about that gap in both ways because it means that like the theory of change for translating research into policy is not only we take this thing that we and our brilliant researcher minds have built and give it to everybody else, but we also find tweaks and changes to make the things that the sector already knows how to deliver more effective and more cost effective. And there's really a two-way direction of learning. But the challenge right now, the real world implications that you asked about, are that both of those gaps remain. There are a number of things that are proven effective, but for all of the very difficult logistical and operational and policy reasons that Jeannie described, are not widely taken up. And that can be the difference between, as she said, only 1 in 5 children receiving this life-saving treatment and actually the ability to deliver that proportional to the need, you know, especially as acute malnutrition is spiking with the current crisis. So the real world impacts there are very, very large, and the potential for change, if you can bridge that gap, is enormous.
There's so many things that you've mentioned already that we need to discuss in more detail. So let's see if we can do that. First of all, as you say, you design, test, and scale ways to help people that are affected by conflict and disaster. Let's stick with design first. Tell me more about those skills, the design skills that you bring together.
So one is a human-centered design. This is now used much more in development, but it really focuses on the end user or the people who are going to be using or taking up, whether it's health treatment or an economic program or the students or the teachers who are using the curriculum or receiving the curriculum, and thinks about the intervention from their lives, from their perspective, every day, how they're going to experience it, from how they think about the problem, whether they even think it's a problem, what the rest of their life looks like, not just the moment that they're supposed to be receiving this intervention. And it's really relentlessly focused on this kind of methodological way. So, and a lot of that is qualitative methods and journey mapping, looking at what their life looks like, but also a lot of observation and just how people use the things that are given to them. And then tweaking every part of the intervention so that it is desirable and easy to use from their perspective. And I keep emphasizing their perspective because so often and way too often programs have been designed from people who aren't the users.
Yeah.
I mean, and whether that's people in DC or people in Nairobi, the designers from public health or from government or NGOs or academics are designing these programs based on the best evidence, but in this ideal sense of what the evidence suggests should be used so that we can optimize the results, but not really from this lens of minute to minute and daily life of the people who are going to be using it. And so that is the design and the human-centered both mindset and methods that come in to really say, how do we use the evidence of what we know works in malnutrition or in education, but design everything around it so that people will be more likely to use it and even enjoy the use of it from an education perspective, for example, that students will enjoy it, teachers will find it easier, and that friction, as is talked about in the private sector sometimes, will reduce the friction of use and increase the uptake. And then we draw a lot on behavioral science, so in terms of how we can bring in, and of course, a lot of that evidence has been developed in high-income countries, but increasingly we have evidence also about how our knowledge about behavioral insights and how people are more likely to take something up or use something will work. And so we use that to design this. And I think it makes a world of difference in what are the tweaks around the edges, especially of what our interventions look like.
These design skills exist in other domains, as you say, in high-income countries. They are routinely used almost now. Do you feel that they have traditionally been neglected in these development contexts?
The human-centered design especially has been used in the private sector. I mean, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a business that doesn't use some human-centered design for customer-facing interventions. And behavioral science, I mean, most experiments, most of the economic work and psychology, social psychology that brings us behavioral science has been in high-income countries. But again, increasingly, I think both the discipline of behavioral science and the skills of human-centered design are being used in development and low- and middle-income countries. Our aim at IRC is that they're increasingly used in humanitarian settings, fragile settings as well.
Now, when an intervention has positive results, not all do, but when they do, it's still very hard to work out whether this would be the best use of scarce resources. This is something that certainly all the researchers I speak to find extremely difficult. What skills can you bring to this?
This is something I've worked on my whole career, and it is perpetually a source of amusement to me that these incredibly smart folks, you know, what we're training kind of PhD economists, social science researchers to do is these really incredibly wonderfully in-depth studies of impact and mechanisms and so forth. And then figuring out actually how much the darn thing cost that you have 17 regression tables is very, very hard. In terms of skills, I think I am a general issue microeconomist. I have the very, very most basics, and I have some predisposition to love Microsoft Excel. But I think what the really important skills are for thinking about how much things cost and comparatively, how much difference are different programs going to make per dollar you spend on them, partly comes down to what I think of as descriptive research skills. In the same way that somebody might capture monitoring data on a program's implementation, can we capture data on how much it costs to do this thing? How much staff time, how much building space, in a way that's not just about getting at that bottom line dollar total, but actually descriptively understanding what went into it. And doing that in a detailed, thorough way is not glamorous. It's not, in most cases, publishable. But I think you do have to get into that in-depth descriptive work. And then the other element that I think is really important is being able to think about what are relevant comparisons, what are relevant options for somebody actually considering this program. And there's a spectrum of kinds of cost analysis, best use of resources analysis, ranging from the, I'm going to do a study in The Lancet, which shows that in general, interventions like this are always more cost effective than interventions like that. We should prioritize this area. But a lot of what's needed, and I think where some of the frustration comes from, is the need to localize that and say, well, does that apply in this country to this policymaker? I worked on deworming earlier in my career, and I remember having this moment of like, do we need to adjust the estimate for the median burden of worms in any country in the world? And like, somehow this search for external validity by like tweaking the numbers. And I finally, I thought for quite a long time, and I was like, well, that's It's kind of a dumb train of thought. Maybe you just don't do deworming in countries that don't have a high worm burden. And the median is much less interesting than how cost-effective this is in a country in which it's relevant. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is the other element. You need this good descriptive work, and then you need some amount of just practical thinking through and collaboration with the people who would implement programs to say, what's feasible for you? What's realistic? And then what would it look like to implement these things in your country? And that, to me, is the most fun of all this process. It's not just about arriving at one beautifully, perfectly externally valid cost estimate. It is about thinking through the future of what would it look like to take this program and run it here? What are the economies of scale that are available? What are the input costs in this context? And what does that mean?
Well, as well as Microsoft Excel, other spreadsheets are available. And I get the feeling, Caitlin, you've used all of them over time. Now, the other thing that often I end up discussing is the problem of scaling up interventions. You do it in one place, it works really well. You try to scale it up, and then that effect is diluted, disappears completely sometimes. What can your approach do to prevent this happening?
So we actually just published a paper recently that I think is relevant for this question. It was a really in-depth cost-effectiveness analysis on a literacy program in Pakistan that looked at many different mechanisms for improving student literacy. We gave out reading and learning materials. We did teacher training. We did coaching. We did teacher learning circles and looked at all of these things and the contribution they had to impact in an impact evaluation. But at the same time, we did a costing study, and it had this very strong descriptive element, like I mentioned, that was, what is the individual cost of each of these components? And as we studied this program, we began to realize there was so much infrastructure sitting underneath each of the elements that were being delivered. And the impact evaluation was picking up on the incremental contribution of the teacher training or the reading and learning materials or so forth. But actually, when you look at the program as a whole and all of the kinds of challenges that you think about when you're trying to scale something up, do we have permission to work in this district? Do we have the buy-in of the ministry staff who need to work on this? That was actually showing up in our cost estimates, and we were able to capture that as a distinct set of activities. Mm-hmm. And I think my read of this problem of impact not replicating when scaled, this is maybe very heavily informed by my work in education, is that we don't always pay attention to the other factors that are present in order to implement XYZ intervention for which I have this precisely estimated impact very faithfully and appropriately in that context. And especially when you're talking about scale up with a transition from, you know, an NGO to a government or a small scale NGO to a large scale NGO. I think there is a lot that's taken for granted that I can actually take this intervention and plop it in. And there was no interaction. The margin at which I implement this intervention doesn't matter. When in fact, if you just take the descriptive fact of the resources that we need to implement any of these things, it's very, very high. And I don't think that's waste. I think that's actually people knowing what's important to get reading and learning materials distributed or teachers attending training regularly. So that's how we have been thinking about approaching this problem is, again, starting from this descriptive lens of what's actually going into it when it's working, and then seeing if the intervention is implemented faithfully with fidelity, and what is the operational environment needed to make that happen. And I think that also then touches back to the question you asked earlier about the skill set for scale up, because you need to have that kind of practical conversation of in the education space. Another trivial example that proves the point is all the wonderful work that Pratham has done in India on remedial learning. All of that works exceptionally well in India because there is a pool of literate volunteers and there is a tradition of volunteering and civil society mobilization around literacy. That needs to be described. It's not just a dollar figure. That's a resource that goes into it. And if I don't have those things in a new country, a highly mobilized civil society, a pool of people who have a basic level of literacy and will volunteer, it's not going to work. So I think it is that descriptive work and then that curiosity about where are we trying to do this and are the same conditions for success present here.
Now, we've been discussing how to take things that work and make them work as well as possible in as many places as possible. But the flip side of that is that we come across programs that are sometimes widely implemented, but there really isn't a strong evidence base to show that they do work. Why does this happen?
I think there are a couple of reasons for this. One is just people become attached to particular programs. And I think we all do this in different ways in our lives. And you have some experience, I'll say, that gives you positive feedback. So you have teachers saying they really like doing this program. You have clinicians or community health workers saying that they like this program. And so you're receiving some feedback. I think it's very unlikely that people are doing programs that are getting a lot of pushback. And so I think there people enjoy a particular program, they get used to a particular program, and they get some positive feedback. And I would categorize these kinds of programs in two different ways. There are programs where we don't have the evidence, where we don't know whether they work or don't work and haven't tested them. People are doing maybe the best they know of, and we need to then build that evidence and go out and test those programs. There are others where people continue to do a program where there's a better program that can replace it. And I think about those two different ways. I think the other reasons though, that people continue on programs in either of these categories is that people are stretched for time, those who are delivering programs. So one, they're attached to the programs. The other is, and this is true for IRC colleagues, they are implementing in incredibly challenging contexts. I just got back from Northeast Nigeria, where not only is there active conflict and security issues, but while I was there, there was a fuel shortage. And so people just couldn't operate the generators anymore. I had to start turning them off in the office, along with 1,000 other challenges that I could name. And so to say, let's stop this program and take a step back and think about what's the evidence out there? What else could we be doing? How could we do a different program is really hard for people who are directly implementing programs. And that's part of what Airbell and IRC technical teams are trying to support our country program teams to be able to do. How do we make that cost evidence? Caitlin was just talking about the different ways of tweaking programs. How do we make that more accessible and usable and help them have space also to make some of those decisions so that they are able to change when a donor opportunity comes up and we can have a space to redesign the program? And then I'll end by, I think the third reason is donors. I think donors also have their favorite pet projects. They often ask for things to be designed really quickly. They give year-to-year grants that don't give space to design that. And so people do the best they can with the best available information that they have. And I think allowing longer-term funding, also where there's an inception phase, FCDO is one donor that does this well, that allows people to have some space to take a step back and think about how could we do something differently? How could we implement? What's the evidence that's out there is really critical to making those, what we termed at one point at IRC, stop and swap. You know, stop, take a look at the program and think about what else could be swapped in for this program.
It is tempting, isn't it, to think of donors, policymakers, as somehow not doing their job properly. But it might also be the case that they're overwhelmed by information that perhaps is very difficult to understand. Could we do a better job at presenting information in the sort of language they speak so that they can make these decisions better?
I think that's very much the case. And it's been quite interesting. I think that has been one of the major roles that having cost data has served at the IRC. It's, as Jeannie has described, our staff, our donor counterparts in the countries in which we work, our donor counterparts at headquarters are tremendously strapped for time, for attention. There is so much information. I think of everything in terms of constrained optimization. These are such highly constrained situations where you're dealing with not only something that is very difficult day to day, but something that is changing with something like a fuel shortage or a security incident or something like that. What becomes difficult then is cutting through the noise of everything that's happening and thinking about the magnitudes of difference that new approaches can bring. And that's where I think the cost stuff has come in very strongly, is to say, we can say this has a such and such standard deviation impact, or that this is demonstrated to be a more effective approach. What people tend to want to know is, how different is that from business as usual? And is that feasible in the operating budget and the resource environment and all the constraints? Our research colleagues and our technical colleagues are the experts on getting incredibly in depth on what is precisely the right thing to do in this place for all of these many, many reasons. And that's exactly why they're good at their jobs. But sometimes what's difficult then is actually saying, okay, of the 10 reasons why you think this is the right thing, what's the one or two most important that this guy that I have to consider is going to care about? Partly it's a translation issue. Partly I think it is just like a prioritization or a discipline issue of saying, I care about this for all of these reasons. We're all very passionate about our work. I have so much feeling about all of the different ways in which this is the right thing, or we need to shift in this evidence-based way. But what's the one that matters to the person I'm talking to, and how can I articulate that as crisply and directly as possible?
I want to rewind you back to 2016, where the big event in humanitarian aid was the grand bargain, this idea that everyone would cooperate to deliver aid more efficiently, more effectively, with more of an evidence base. And then what happened is by the end of it, not a lot of progress had been made. It kind of showed up how much of aid delivery is earmarked for particular purposes or delivered inflexibly through multinational agencies or is done on a short-term way that you spoke about earlier. So it seems we've stuck no matter what evidence that we have. Can we change this?
My observation of the grand bargain, I've worked on some of the work streams relating to efficiency, to harmonized reporting, transparency, is that it was so all-encompassing in the level of ambition, which, as I said earlier, is logical. You have a lot of people who care deeply about these issues who want to push forward different aspects of reform. And you have these highly, highly constrained environments, not only the operating environments, but I would say constrained by congressional directives or auditing procedures or whatever the legislature of the donor country is choosing to prioritize that year. And it's a really, really difficult coordination problem. And trying to solve for so many different things through such a complicated system, in many cases across the board, progress was not made. And I think that can't really shy away from that. Our response to this in the space in which I work has been over time to get basically narrower and narrower and narrower and to say, what is the one thing that if we could change this would make the greatest amount of difference in the quality of services, the efficiency of services that we can deliver to our clients? And I do think that there is still some hope for that approach of triaging to some extent and saying, we're not going to do this massive bargain of everybody trading to everybody. It's just too complicated of a market to even conceive of. But there are a few things that we have found alignment around and that have a really high margin of impact. I'm thinking here particularly around this issue of very short-term funding. When I started at IRC, they said the median length of a grant was 11 months. And if you throw in sometimes 1 to 2 months of contracting delays, it is almost impossible to be efficient, let alone innovative in that time frame. And we've done a couple studies recently looking at how cost efficient are our services delivered through shorter versus longer term programs, just to bound our understanding of actually how much of a difference this could make. This not gigantic shift from, let's say, a 12-month to a 24-month program. And I myself have been surprised by the magnitude of results in two cases we've looked at. One was a program delivering water and sanitation kits in Northeast Nigeria. Another was cash programs in Somalia. We saw that the shift from one-year programming to two, or in one case, four-year programming, brought down the delivery cost per dollar of goods going out the door by like 45 or 50%. It's actually very, very big gains from specific discrete changes like that. And so for me, that's how I think about the way forward on change, is it's probably not sweeping and transformative and all-encompassing, but that doesn't mean that specific things are not worth doing. And there are still very discrete chunks of work that were under the umbrella of the grand bargain that could make a meaningful difference in the quality and amount of services that we're able to deliver.
I agree with all of that. Even if, and I hope and we need these changes to happen in terms of the multi-year programming, but even within the many constraints that we have with our current funding, as an implementing organization, we can continue to make our programs more effective and more efficient. The whole sector changed from not using cash to now cash being central to our emergency and protracted crisis responses. And so that's now a bit old news, but it was a big shift that meant that now people are receiving cash when they need it. You know, now our questions are, should we be giving them a big lump sum at the beginning of an emergency? Can we do that in a preventative way through predicting disaster in a better way so that people are better off? And is that how they want to receive funding in terms of a lump sum? So there are many other questions to ask that we can still both use the evidence, but also improve our programming, even with status quo funding. We can make sure that we're having more economies of scale. We can make sure that our programs are based on evidence. So we can still improve even within these constraints as implementing organizations, but we do need donors to change to increase those gains, as Caitlin said.
Well, there are so many questions to ask, and it really is inspiring to hear that you're asking them and finding some of the answers as well. Thank you very much for talking to me about them today. Thank you, Caitlin and Jeannie.
Thank you so much, Tim.
Thanks, Tim.
If you want to find out more about Airbell Labs, then go to the website. It's at airbell.rescue.org. Or if you want to read their blog, it's at medium.com/airbell. And that's spelled A-I-R-B-E-L. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, our past episodes are always at voxdev.org, where you will also be able to read articles about the papers we feature.